listening to Frank Prattle. My name is Zephyr Thrall, here on Art International Radio or artonair.org. You might also be listening at www.frankprattle.com. Today, unlike any other day in your entire life, you'll be listening to Mungo Thompson right now. We're inside the belly of the beast, John Conley Presents, here on West 27th, although we're kind of in some netherworld space that used to be Nada right now. Hi, Mungo.
Hi.
How are you?
Good.
You're all a flutter with the butterflies, I assume. Your opening's in half an hour.
I'm fine. I'm good. My ears are turning red from the from coming in from the cold.
Yeah.
But I feel fine. I feel good.
Tell us a little bit about this show that you have.
This exhibition is, let's see, consists of a vinyl record and two 16mm films and a few drawings in the back room. The record, you can actually hear it distantly, is on one side recordings of birds that have been slowed down 16 times to sound like whale song, and on the reverse side, whales that have been sped up 16 times to sound like birds. And the whales are playing inside the gallery, and the birds, quote-unquote birds, are playing on speakers on the front of the building out into the street.
Wait, stop. Reverse that.
Just kidding. I actually don't think I can. That took a lot of concentration. So
you have an auditory component, and then you also have some films as well.
Yeah, there's two films. One is... the show is named after it. It's called The Varieties of Experience, and it's I borrowed a dirty copy of Nam June Paik's Zen for Film from 1962 and from the Paik estate with the cooperation of the Paik estate.
And for those listening who don't know what that movie is, it's Paik, he had just a blank piece of film that he let...
Film leader, yeah.
Right, that he let this detritus and scum of the air... make into a movie.
Yeah. So his film is a clear white film, which over time sort of happens to collect the dust from the spaces where it's exhibited. And my observation was that dust is largely composed of human cells, and therefore the audience of the work was embedded in it. So I worked with the estate to get an old copy of it that had never been cleaned and printed it as a negative, used as a negative to make a new print, which would sort of capture all that stuff as imagery. So mine is a black film, and the specks appear as little white sparks and motes and bits going by. And it's a little bit evocative of a starscape or something. I was sort of interested in looping that back up into the cosmos, we're composed of the same of stuff that was generated by the Big Bang. So I wanted to picture space with that stuff, if you know what I'm saying. The other film is called one of those titles with untitled with a parenthesis after it. It's untitled Margot Levin Gallery 1972, and there's no closing date because she's still open and still around. Margot Levin Gallery is my Los Angeles art gallery, and she opened in 1970. The film is a stop motion animation of her Rolodexes,
right?
Which she's had all this time, and which are
well loved.
Yeah, which have been well thumbed through and have received a lot of attention over the decades. And so that was another way of looking at the sort of systemic apparatus that grows up around the viewing of art, and that,
right,
you know, everybody from electricians and customs experts and the alarm company and liquor delivery and everything else to collectors and artists florists and
preparators, so,
yeah, everything. The whole sort of system is present, and I'm sort of interested in how it's organized around this in this single place, and then transposing that to film. It's a Super 16 film. Super 16 and Rolodex cards have a they share a common aspect ratio, and they both Super 16 and the Rolodexes are sort of pre-digital dinosaurs that are sort of on their way out. And Margot's, I think her last entries are like 2005. The gallery's gone digital, but the Rolodexes are still around, and I've always been interested in them. So I borrowed them and made this stop motion film with them as the star.
Yeah. So I mean, one of the definite themes of this show is kind of the disappearing technology. With, you know, you have template pieces, you have 16 millimeter film, you have vinyl records, you have Rolodexes, things like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, what's your fascination with the dying? Is it a nostalgia that you're feeling? For,
no.
You
know? No, I'm just interested in the way that things come and go. And I guess I sort of view them as a filter through which to view the things we prize now. And, you know, like my iPhone, which I am, you know...
You love it?
Well, I'm sort of surgically attached to it.
Do you have the level feature?
Yes, I do, actually. I always thought I would use it in an installation. I never have.
You hear it? You hear that, Steve Jobs?
My undergraduate degree was in photography, and I always took this sort of Roland Barthes idea to heart, which is that every photograph is a death. You know, that as soon as you take that photograph, the thing is lost because it marks a moment that can never come again. And so it's not nostalgia so much as an interest in that sentiment. It's not nostalgia so much as an interest in that notion, the notion of trying to sort of briefly capture something that's lost and this sort of something that's going away. I made a film a few years ago called The Swordsman, and it's about a Hollywood sword master. He was the guy who was Darth Vader's stunt double, and he was, you know, the fight choreographer, and the term is sword master, the guy who handles all the fighting equipment for these sort of swashbuckling films. Everything from Errol Flynn to, you know, up to Pirates of the Caribbean. And he was the guy off camera throwing the stunt sword.
Right, right.
And I made a film of him sort of as if you swiveled the camera to the right and he was throwing the stunt sword handle first off camera. So... But it just so happened that was my interest in making that film, was just to like turning the camera to the right. But it did end up being about this fading art. And because he was 82, he was in his retirement home in Florida. And
did he really throw to Errol Morris then if he was 82?
Errol Flynn.
Yes.
The Adventures of Robin Hood, yeah.
That was him,
1939.
Then.
Yeah, he has a really long and storied career. He's a really amazing guy, Bob Anderson. And, you know, he did the Lord of the Rings film, The Princess Bride, and Barry Lyndon, and, you know, he's...
Anything with swords.
Yeah, all swords. And lightsabers. And but because of the context, because of these sort of, you know, everything about it, you know, sort of became demonstrative of the eclipsing of his art by new art, new technologies, and you know, computer-generated graphics and martial arts, you know, the fetish for martial arts in films at the moment. So he, to some extent, was being eclipsed by these things, and it ended up being a little bit of a meditation on these things that fade and go away and can't be replaced. And these sort of authentic instances that are real and... beautiful in their own way, but you know, but passing, transient.
One of the questions I have is that a lot of your work seems to be kind of riffing or vamping, or kind of repurposing, you know, resituating things, and that you know that are common things already around us. and such as, you know, as you just described it, turning the camera to the right instead of, you know, just focusing directly on, you know, what is typically known as the action. Where do you get this inspiration from? Is it something that started young that, you know, you've often wanted to pull back the wizard's curtain?
There is a little bit of that. There is a little bit of this sort of like that sort of Benjaminian notion that every transmission is a sort of message to be decoded, and it's our sort of job as a dynamic citizen to deconstruct this barrage as it comes at us, for the hidden ways that it's organized and the values that it's actually transmitting, as opposed to the values it claims to be transmitting. But it's not all about a kind of suspicion of the sinister status quo at all. It's to some extent just about momentarily defamiliarizing the world in a way that in a context that's familiar, just to sort of momentarily reanimate the world in a sense, like to make it strange just for a moment, so that you sort of stall out for a second. The Light and Space guys used to talk about how they were interested in stopping the viewer at the moment of pre-gating. It's sort of the instant prior to the interpretive. So where you're just pure receiver, and you see yourself seeing, right? And you become awakened as a subject. And that's something that's really interesting. But I'm actually interested in the moment that happens kind of a few seconds later, where actually the associative flood begins and you start to reorganize the world. And this all happens, you know, in a flash of neurons, of course. But I'm interested in it, in when it is reorganized, is anything different when it's all back in place, and does it fall back into the same place? So that's kind of how I think about it. It's kind of a just a tendency to look just slightly to the side, as you said, you know, kind of bright in the corners. My piece at the Whitney last year.
Let's talk about this. Hold on, let me give a brief description. All right, so I go to the Whitney Biennial, I show up, and you know, the Whitney Biennial in my mind is the best salad bar in town. And even on the best salad bar, you have, you know, a lot of rotten olives and some crappy romaine that is brown around the edges. But you know, you also have some amazing pineapple in there too. And so I show up, I give my jacket, I notice this crazy cacophonously beautiful hum, and then I go up and see the rest of the Whitney. And then I come back down and get my jacket, and there's a little girl standing there, like, talking to somebody. I don't know who she's talking to. I thought she was on the phone at first. She was maybe like 10 or something like that. But she was talking about what she was hearing, which were your chimes. And then she was pointing at a little sign to the right. And I was like, what is she? And then I listened, and I was like, whoa, that is a noise. That is a noise unto itself. And in the perfect Eno sense, it had totally become subliminal, you know, ambient in the true sense of ambient, just influencing mood without being present. And this was your piece, Coat Check Chimes.
I replaced all the hangers in the museum's coat check with custom-tuned metal hangers that were still fully functional, practical hangers and held coats, and as a result, parts of the, you know, quote unquote instrument were muffled at all times, you know, depending on the number of visitors to the museum, or depending on the weather, depending on any number of sort of chance factors. There was the overall composition was always evolving and changing, and from, you know, hour to hour, day to day. And your story is really ideal, actually. I'm glad you shared it with me. It's really the perfect, it's what I hoped for, in the sense that it was something you could miss. I'm interested in this possibility, that it could slip right by. But if you don't miss it, it actually becomes kind of special.
I have to tell you, I've told, I don't know, maybe 20 friends about this, and only one of them had saw your piece.
Yeah, yeah.
The rest were like, no, I didn't see that one.
Well, this gets back to kind of what we were saying before. I think in a way, by citing it there, first of all, if you checked your coat and got it again, usually you probably saw it. But if you didn't, you know, you missed it. But but also, in most exhibition circumstances, you get on the elevator and you go upstairs and you get off and you see the big sign that says, you know, 2008 Whitney Biennial. And then you turn your sort of art antenna on, kind of. But until that point, you're just a human sort of moving.
No
through,
art here.
Moving forward, moving forward through space. And your openness to experience is different. So I'm actually trying to sort of disrupt that slightly. So in a way, my piece sort of framed the whole show, or it was not in it. You know, you might even say it simply was not in it. Yeah, that is the kind of the experience you had is the kind of experience I wanted to engender. And,
now I heard something that your piece might have exited a bit early though as well. And this I don't know might just be rumor that there were some pretty severe complaints by the coat check people about the sound of it. Was that true? Do you know about that?
Yeah, did you? There was actually a piece on NPR where about that. They didn't take it down early or anything, but they and I don't think there was anything formal going on, but there was definitely a couple guys who didn't like it. It was, you know, it was actually kind of a instructive in terms of like the nature of audience. You know, there were those who were totally into it, like I get to be part of one of the projects in the show, and then there were people who like this is a pain in the ass, and I'm just trying to listen to the, you know,
my Rush Limbaugh,
well, or something, and yeah, I mean, all you can do with the work is try and get people to follow along. You can't make them, so. I was sort of like, why would you, you know, it's not a Bruce Nauman, it's not a Tony Orsler, it's not sitting there screaming at you. But if it bothers you, you know, that's unfortunate. It was designed to be melodic and mood enhancing, but I think there were people who found it cacophonous and difficult, and you know, that's unfortunate. But
I'll get their addresses.
My feeling about that is that you can only sort of do what you do. We went to actually really extreme lengths to make sure that they were really highly functional, that they, that they weren't heavy, that they, you know, were load bearing, that they, you know, that pretty much address every conceivable concern they could have. So after that, at a certain point, you just have to say, oh, well.
Yeah. Well, given that, kind of dovetailing off of that, what would you say is your greatest mistake that you've made? I know it's a zinger, sorry.
Man, I should have a prepared answer for that.
Fifth grade, Mrs. Hall.
Well, I guess I've made works that later I wish I'd made differently, but I've overhung shows. That's something I've done. I don't know. I don't know if I can answer that.
There's no supreme regret burning its way through your heart and back pocket?
No. Maybe if we spent the weekend together.
Alone on the coast, you mean?
You know, it would come to me. But if I think of something, I'll let you know.
Okay. So, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but you're living now in Los Angeles and Berlin?
Yeah, primarily Los Angeles with some time spent in Berlin, sort of summers in Berlin at the moment. It's been a little tricky because we have a new baby.
Right.
So that's complicated our bicontinental aspirations.
Well, I myself am a fan of the odd name. You know, your name being Mungo, my name being Zephyr.
Mm-hmm.
What is your child's name?
Eno.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Get out.
Yeah.
Well, I'll be damned. Well, that's for the listening audience, I did not know that previously. That's great. Tell me a little bit about Berlin, though. Many people, you know, kind of view it as, you know, New York has, with the financial collapse and London shitting the bed as well, that the art scenes are leaving these two, you know, megaliths, these metropolitan kind of centers. And many people think that Berlin is where it will kind of land next. What are your thoughts on that?
I think that a lot of hardcore Berlin people would say Berlin is already over too. in the sense that, you know, they've sort of been there from the beginning, and they think it's being ruined by art tourism. But for me personally, LA was starting to, I was starting to feel like I was hitting a wall there, and my wife got this great residency at the American Academy in Berlin. Her name is Carrie Tribe. She's an artist as well. And she and I went to Berlin and just ended up staying and staying and staying. And we had had our son there. And we got a place there. And now we go ideally in the summers, although we didn't go at all last year. So for us, it's been a really productive, stimulating place. It's very collegial. There's no money, so the degree of competition is, quote unquote, competition is pretty minimal, which is very different situation than New York. I feel like the second I get through the tunnel,
the dogs are barking.
Yeah, the dogs are barking, and so I think it's a great place, but I'm not in a position to predict its ascendancy. You know, I just think it's a nice, kind of easy place to be an artist with a lot of other really good artists around without having to endure the same kind of struggle that you do here.
So let's say I whooped out of my back pocket a collapsible but yet very long extending fairy wand, and with this wand I was to poof produce a checkbook. And this checkbook's giant. I mean, it's, you know, 20 feet long, and I have a pen the size of a sequoia, what have you, and I make out a check for $25 million, and I hand you this behemoth. What would you do with that check? What is the ultimate art project that you've never had enough money?
I had a guy in my studio recently ask me that.
He asked you that exact question? He said a checkbook the size of a...
No, a minus flatbed truck. Minus the, you know, novelty check. He's organizing some public art stuff and was sort of asking, okay, what is your wish list for projects? And I kind of have a long one, but today I'll just say buying dead air on all the radio stations.
Ooh.
How about that?
Delicious. And you could broadcast it all to John Cage's grave. Well, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
My name is Zephyr Throle. You're listening to Frank Prattle here on Art International Radio, artonair.org, or frankprattle.com. Mungo Thompson, man about town, goddamn genius in my book. Thank you so much.
Thank you.